You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 6th of July 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
Europe must do more. Europe must demonstrate that it believes in its future by investing its money to secure that future.
U.S. President Donald Trump visits Poland and warns Europe of the decadence of Western civilization, which quite a lot of Europeans believe he kind of represents. My guests Quentin Peel and Michael Goldfarb will be discussing that and the day's other top stories, including the EU's conclusion of a free trade deal with Japan, which might not have been timed exclusively to tease Britain, the resumption of hostilities between Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and Germany, and should we start churning our own butter in anticipation of a festive shortage? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Quentin Peel, Associate Fellow at Chatham House and contributor to the FT, and Michael Goldfarb, the author and broadcaster. Welcome both. We will start in Poland, where US President Donald Trump has stopped off en route to the G20 summit in Hamburg. President Trump is marginally less disliked in Poland than he is elsewhere in Europe. Poland's government does share certain of his paranoid nativist views, especially in regard to Muslim immigration. Trump spoke today at the memorial to the 1944 Warsaw Uprising, using the site as the cue for a curious disquisition on the need to defend Western civilization from a bewildering array of threats, including Islamist terrorism, Russia, and governmental bureaucracy. Michael, first of all, why did he pick on Poland as his place to stop off?
Poland couldn't get out of the way in time. No, really. I
mean, it's been the story of its history, pretty much.
I know.
Well,
geography is destiny. I leave that out there for all my Polish friends. Look, you know, There were two purposes for this trip. One is that the Polish government is actually an outlier in Europe at the moment. It is run by essentially by the Kaczynskis, even though they're not in power, not in office, and they are a nationalist, hard right party, and their worldview probably matches Donald Trump's in a lot of ways, and they are critical of the European Union. But you also have to remember that this was like basically a 16-hour stopover, and it was mostly a photo op for the folks back home, meaning the Trump supporters back home. And I think that much of the speech was actually aimed, as Glenn Thrush of the New York Times said in a tweet, it's aimed at Mobile, Alabama. It isn't necessarily aimed at the Polish nation. Most of the crowd was bussed in, and it's not clear how much of the speech they actually understood, but on cue from time to time, They would chant Donald Trump, Donald Trump, and I can assure you that Fox News will be replaying those clips for several days.
Quentin, he did talk quite a lot about the Polish nation. There were several paragraphs of the usual boilerplate about the resilience and fighting spirit of the Polish people, all of it thoroughly merited, of course, and all of it no more or less than any president of the United States would say in Poland. Beyond that, what did you make of it? All the sort of dire warnings about whether Western civilization has the will to save itself, etc., etc., etc.
Well, I worry a bit about just what Donald Trump thinks, what is his definition of the West, because I suspect there are a lot of people in Europe who think that he is himself really quite a threat to the cohesion of the West,
indeed,
rather than anybody else. But he did manage to press a few of the buttons that, if you like, his European audience have been begging him to press. One very critical one was finally saying, yes, we do support Article 5 of the NATO treaty. That's to say, mutual defence pact. We will come to the aid of anybody who is threatened. And he did make some pretty critical noises about Russia, in particular that Russia was destabilising Ukraine, furiously denied in Moscow, and that they were supporting governments he doesn't like in Syria and Iran. So it was a more balanced Donald Trump within the symbol symbolism of going to Poland today, which is itself regarded by many of its European partners as having a rather difficult and not very democratically conscious government, populist government in Poland, but with a nationalism that may be rather parallel to Donald Trump's nationalism. Well,
what's interesting of Quentin is that before he gave his speech, he did actually talk to the press, which is a very rare occasion, and he was asked directly. Eventually, he took a question on what Russia may or may not have been doing with the American election. And there it was a slightly different tone. It's like, yes, well, Russia may have done, but other people do it too. And it was far less assertively anti-Russia than the prepared remarks that he read off the teleprompter next to the memorial to the Warsaw Uprising in 1944. So, you know, you still come away on any given day, you can't understand or have a sense of just what he really thinks. Although I have to say that he read the speech very, very well. I assume it was written by his main advisor, Steve Bannon. It was, touched all the points there.
I was literally going to ask you exactly that.
I read your mind.
Whether you detected job. The hand of Steve Bannon. And also wanted to follow up the thing you were saying about how it was made with the audience at home in Mobile, Alabama in mind, because it did rather remind me in tone of a lot of the speeches he made in the campaign, in which he performed this ludicrous con trick of going out in front of the United States of America, the richest, mightiest, strongest, most prosperous and secure nation ever on earth, and told everybody that it was a crumbling ruin, etc., etc. And he's saying the same to Europe. Western Europe is as rich, secure, pleasant, stable, orderly, organized, etc., etc., a civilization as has ever been gathered under, well, not just one flag, but several. And yet he is trying to sell us the idea that there are, well, literally, I suspect, in his head, barbarians at the gates.
Well, I mean, it's a way of getting into the other thing, which is the other Steve Bannon thing, which is the war for civilization with Islam. What he told this rambling monologue, anecdote about the collapse of communism in Poland. And he said, or Steve Bannon wrote for him to say, you know, that finally when communism collapsed, you didn't ask for more money. You didn't ask for all of these worldly goods. What did you ask for? You asked for more God. Here in America, we ask for more God. All over Europe, we ask for... I go out quite a bit. I do a lot of reporting. Other than the southern part of the United States, I know of no place where people ask for more God, especially in Poland, which is, you know, one of the most observant nations in Europe, and where people don't feel threatened about being able to practice Catholicism exactly the way Pope John Paul II wanted them to. I mean, that kind of thing is all part of this. I don't know how much traction it really gets outside of his very, very devoted base of evangelical Christianity in America.
Quentin, just finally on this, looking ahead to the G20, Trump has arrived in Germany today, I believe. What's a best case scenario? What is the ideal in terms of this latest attempt by Donald Trump to interact with fellow world leaders?
Well, on the face of it, it looks like he's going to be a rather lonely man at this G20. Certainly, Angela Merkel has made it very clear that as chair of the meeting, she's putting climate change right up there, on which he's the one who's walked away from the Paris Agreement, and the other 19 are all still signed up to it. So it could be very difficult. I think I wouldn't really like to be in Angela Merkel's shoes for this G20 meeting, because she's got three very difficult people to deal with: Donald Trump, Vladimir Putin, and President Erdogan of Turkey, and they're all going to give her a headache, I think.
Well, let's move along somewhat. Here in the UK, nobody yet appears to have the least idea of how Britain will reach the sunlit uplands of prosperity promised by those who advocated Brexit. With exquisite comic timing, coming, the EU has today announced a free trade deal with Japan, a free trade deal which, of course, the UK will no longer be part of when or if it finally gets its things packed. The deal has been 5 years in the making. Once formalised, its effects are likely to be especially noticeable in the trading of automobiles and agricultural produce. Quentin, first of all, it's taken 5 years to get to this point. It may take another 15 to implement fully. Should that sort of timescale be worrying UK's Brexit negotiators more than it appears to be?
Yes, it certainly should. It certainly shows what a bloody long time it takes to negotiate these things. Mind, the timing of this sort of, if you like, almost agreement in principle that they've announced today undoubtedly owes something both to the impetus of one Donald Trump, who is clearly walking away from trade deals, and in particular the one that the TPP deal that the US was supposed to sign with Japan is ditch that, and Brexit, where the Brits are walking away from Europe saying, we can do better. And it is going to be a very considerable challenge to the British government to say, right, now do better for Britain than the EU has just done with Japan. It's an interesting deal because it does start to open up that very protected Japanese agricultural food market, where they've never allowed people near, and there's a significant bit of that for Europe. European food supplies, the Americans would very much like to have access to that food market as well. And it does open up both markets to more cars, which would be a good thing. So I think the Brits are going to be gnashing their teeth about this. And I think Donald Trump, well, he probably won't notice.
Counterpoint, Michael, I'm going to put my Brexiteer hat on here, which I imagine is a bowler hat of some sort, possibly a tricorn. One of those, actually, no, it'll be one of those bowler hat Union Jack things that they wave around at the last night of the proms. That is the hat I am presently wearing. Is there actually an argument here for Brexit in that it demonstrates that it is possible to conclude free trade deals that don't involve freedom of movement?
Well, we don't know what the final agreement will be. And one of the things still is arbitration processes. The European Union would still like to have it, any disputes in a special court that's been set up. And the Japanese are looking for something slightly less judicial as their preferred arbitration process. And of course, part of Brexit is getting away from the European Court of Justice, but also all of these agreements, how will they be adjudicated? No, I have to say, I know you're stretching. I know you're really stretching your imagination there, Andrew, in the interest of balance. And I appreciate the efforts.
And I spent a lot on this hat.
And if the audience could only see it, you can go over to Belfast for the 12th of July and you'll fit right in. Listen, it's like, there's two things. One is cars. How many jobs in the northeast of England depend on the Nissan plant?
7,000.
Exactly. And if Nissan is now going to have a different set of rules, more liberalized, with the EU than it has, I mean, that's a supply chain that's going to be really messed up. But leaving that aside, I think that what everyone needs to think about, especially the real Brexiteers, is if two areas of trade, automobiles and food, is going to have an implementation period, and it's still not a done deal, that might extend to a time horizon of 15 to 20 years. Imagine all of the new deals that have to be negotiated, how long they take to implement and so on, and what will be the transition period. And you begin to understand that even if there is Brexit, and I still think in some form there will be Brexit, you begin to understand that it could be a 20-year process, by which time I certainly, Quentin probably, you not, because you're a younger fellow,
I may have lost the will to live well and truly before then. Quentin, though, it is all going to be okay, I put to you, because we have heard here in the UK, International Trade Secretary Liam Fox has suggested that MPs wear British ties to promote British ties, and Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson has enthused about the company in his constituency. constituency, which makes the wooden counters used to display Toblerones not merely in one Saudi airport, but in every Saudi airport. So this is the future, isn't it? We're going to make ties and wooden stands on which Saudi Arabian duty-free shops can balance Toblerones. It's going to be fine, isn't it?
You do wonder what world they're living in, you know. Just as they seem to be deciding in the House of Commons they don't need to wear ties any longer, we have Liam Fox
That's even more ties that we can sell to people, those ones that the MPs are no longer wearing.
I think the only use of a tie in this modern day and age is to hang a microphone on if you happen to be doing a radio interview. Otherwise, what on earth are they good for?
I thought you were about to quote Trotsky there about bureaucrats and academics or whatever the phrase was. Yes, it is strange, the Saudi Arabian Toblerone outburst.
Oh, I mean, you know, the mind boggles at where it is a really, really desperate situation. We had a big story today, which is actually about Airbus, which is probably going to have to shift most of its manufacturing, if not all its manufacturing in Britain, back over to the European Union if we're not still in the single market or the customs union, because they cannot keep moving this huge amounts they move across borders in the European Union to make these huge aircraft. They can't keep doing it if we're outside.
Michael, is it possible that this is yet another unintended consequence of Brexit, that deals like this between the EU and other great trading powers may actually become easier for the EU once the UK leaves, the UK having been for many years the EU's approximately least cooperative member?
Well, it's interesting. I remember when I first had to cover these areas of trade going back to the early 90s, and Leon Britton.
Yeah.
Was the trade negotiator for the EU. I mean, it's a rotating commission, but the EU actually loved sending British lawyers out into these negotiations, because when it comes to passive aggressive behavior, foot dragging, and, you know, to the point that the people you're negotiating with just throw the contract and say, fine, whatever you want, we'll do it. I mean, the Brits are really good at it. No, I think you do touch on a more important point, though, Andrew. In my FRD Edge podcast, I did one about this when they invoked Article 50. In many ways, the EU will actually work better without the UK, precisely for the reason that you pointed out. The UK has been a drag anchor on many, many initiatives that the other big countries, France and Germany, would like, and they might have been able to have made a better fist of integrating the continent than wasting so many hours at summits trying to accommodate the United Kingdom.
But in the interests of balance, Michael, I would say that on the
question for your people, Quentin.
On the question of free trade, on the question of competition law, these things actually the Brits have been pretty strong on and good on.
Exactly.
And,
right.
And that's going to be a big loss to the rest of the European Union. I mean, I think this process is going to be far more damaging to Britain than it is to the European Union. But nonetheless, those are things that my friends in the Netherlands or in Sweden or indeed in Germany are really quite worried about.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Quentin Peel and Michael Goldfarb. Coming up next, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan resumes hostilities with Germany.
Pack your bags and join us on a global tour through exciting and inspiring cities. From Madrid to Miami, Tokyo to Toronto, we've created travel guides that will help you get the best out of a city, no matter how short your stay. We'll whirl you around some of our favorite architectural spots, top cultural haunts, and then point you in the direction of a well-earned drink from a little-known cocktail bar. We've also scouted the prettiest running routes, the most design-savvy shops, and the best hotels to comfortably rest your head. View our full range of travel guides at monocle.com or visit any good bookstore and plan your next escape today. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Quentin Peel and Michael Goldfarb. Now, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and Germany do have quite a history. Listeners may recall last year's spat involving Erdogan's attempts to get Germany to prosecute a comedian, Jan Böhmermann, who had made a certain amount of fun of him. An exchange of Christmas cards appears even less likely now after Germany forbade Erdogan from addressing Turkish expats while in Hamburg for the G20 this weekend, having previously told him he couldn't bring the bodyguards who'd beaten up protesters in Washington in May. Erdogan has accused Germany, perplexingly, of committing political suicide. Michael, do we have the least idea what Erdogan means by this?
Political suicide? No, I think he's increasingly been given to these sorts of pronouncements. It's an interesting problem in Hamburg in particular, which has a sizable Turkish community. I got a barber shave there on Barenfelder Straße at a Turkish barber because, you get a really good shave from Turkish barbers. And I was so impressed by this barber shop. Three generations of Turks. They played the political game. They had, the chancellor had come by because it was necessary to get Turkish votes. I mean, seriously, and the picture with the barber. And I thought, geez, this is integration. This really is integration. Basically, Erdogan is trying to stir up support for his own regime back in Turkey, and it is just not done. I mean, in a world where so many countries now have sizable immigrant communities from all other places, it's one thing to go and maybe go to the local community association and have traditional food. It's quite another to have essentially a political rally that would be to be going, to be broadcast back into Ankara and Istanbul to consolidate the view of the new sultan. And I do think that Germany was well within its rights to say, no. You can't hold political rallies on our soil.
Well, Germany's reasoning was that they didn't want him, quote, importing domestic political conflicts, unquote, which, put that way, does seem fair enough. Quentin, do we have to start rethinking the idea, or pretense even, that Turkey actually is still a Western ally?
It's a very difficult ally, and it has been for a very long time. But
it's not getting any less difficult.
Absolutely, it's getting more difficult. I think it's another one that fits into Angela Merkel's category of no longer calling them allies, but calling them maybe neighbours or, not entirely reliable partners. It is really worrying, I think, that Erdogan doesn't seem to be able to see that in making what are fundamentally his domestic political case and campaigning in Germany, he's actually undermining everything the Germans are trying to do about integrating their society and saying, we welcome this community as part of Germany. They are German. Mesut Özil is playing for the German football team and he's a German. And so Erdogan just doesn't get that, because what he's doing is deliberately creating a bogeyman of Germany and indeed of wider Europe, the rest of Europe, to get him more votes back home.
There was also, he used some pretty intemperate language about Germany's own past, a dictator-led country. And it's just not done. But, I think to spread this conversation out, at the G20, we're going to have Vladimir Putin, Tayyip Erdogan, Donald Trump, the leaders of Europe, and the leader of China. Syria is at war. The end of ISIS in its current form is at hand. When that happens in Syria and Iraq, all of the alliances that have come together on the ground to make that will dissipate. And suddenly there's going to be this extraordinary, Turkey is not going to want the Kurds, who've been doing all the fighting in Syria, to have any more autonomy. There's going to be a huge backlash. This G20 should be about the leaders of these nations sitting down and plotting some of what comes next there. And instead, you have these, frankly, egomaniacal figures who will be playing mostly to the cameras for their domestic political consumption. And, things are actually extremely dangerous, and that's leaving aside the question of the environment and you know, where these leaders stand on maintaining the Paris Accords, which is apparently the top agenda item for this G20.
Final quick thought on this, Quentin. Turkey is, of course, a member of NATO. It is, in theory, on track to become a member of the EU, though I'm not sure anyone's holding their breath waiting for that to happen. But if we look at Turkey itself, 50,000 people have now been arrested since last year's coup attempt, including, as of today, Amnesty International's actual Turkey director, İdil Eser. Do we actually need to start thinking, I asked earlier, are we still being naive in thinking Turkey of an ally? Do we actually need to start thinking of it like we think of Iran or Russia?
I hope very much not, but I would like to see NATO, which after all Turkey is a very important member of,
the largest military in NATO, I think,
underlining
I'm right
that you've second got largest to be democratic as well to be a fully fledged NATO participant and not just have military equipment on the ground. I think you're right. I think things are going to get worse, but we need Turkey nonetheless to try and control the refugee flows. You know, we have problems on both sides.
Okay, well, finally tonight, though we are at that blessed time of year, which we're about as far from last and next Christmas as it's possible to get, people here in the UK are being warned that this year's Yuletide may be even grimmer than usual. The CEO of European milk cooperative Arla, the largest buyer of UK milk, has warned that there may be a shortage of butter and cream due to insufficient production of milk. By way of precursor, butter prices rose 14% last month to an all-time hi. Michael, are we being subtly prepared here for post-Brexit rationing?
To be honest with you, I'm lactose intolerant. I haven't had an ice cream cone in 40 years.
So you have no personal stake in this story?
I have no stake in this. I wonder, so the story means nothing to me.
This is great. I really like it when guests just come and go, you know what, I couldn't care less.
But if you want to, is there going to be a shortage? I think it would be terrible.
But come on, man, we've got 3.5 minutes to go here. Work with us.
Well, I'm throwing this to Quentin.
Well, as I was walking down Upper Street Islington,
make this a long anecdote.
I indulged in a, God, what was it? It was a
take all the time
black
you like
ice cream. So I have eaten ice cream in a cone in very recent times. I think this is possibly going to solve a big problem in the Peel family. The problem in the Peel family is as follows. Are you allowed, when you have roast potatoes with your roast beef, to have not just gravy but butter as well? The Irish side of my family, which is my wife and all my children, insist you can have both, whereas I, being rather a rigid Protestant Englishman, feel that either gravy or butter. So if we can get butter...
Well, because having both at once is just a grotesque indulgence,
absolutely,
isn't it?
Absolutely.
As I come from
this is basically what the English Civil War was fought over, wasn't it?
But I come from a long line of what can we call them? Galician and Russian and Jews. And so goose fat is actually the best way to prepare a potato. And this may be why I'm lactose intolerant. That generations, centuries, millennia of my Jewish forebears really didn't get down with you know, the milk too much, but relied on the goose fat to roast their potatoes in.
But we've got a problem now. The farmers are so screwed by the supermarkets over the price they're getting for their milk and stuff that they've cut back on dairy production.
Well, they're also screwed or are anticipating being screwed by Brexit. And apparently this is one of the underlying reasons behind it. Butter consumption around the world is up and margarine is down. And no one really knows why. But here the National Farmers Union says that farmers fear raising output and therefore lowering the price because they fear that there will be a crash in demand because they're worried about uncertainty re-Brexit. Michael, this is going to be absolutely every industry in Britain for about the next 300 years, isn't it?
Exactly right. And again, this is one of the mysteries of life in this country, that I have a friend who had quite a large holding in Yorkshire, and one day I was spending the weekend, and on the breakfast table was his EU check from the CAP. And it seems to me impossible that one of the industries in this country where people really did get money back and they could actually see the benefit of being in the European Union voted overwhelmingly to leave the European Union. And I suppose they'll just have to deal directly with Sainsbury's and Waitrose and all the other big supermarket chains and figure out how to plan their production. The other, of course, is the fishing industry, but we won't get into that.
Quentin, if we no longer have cream to ladle all over mince pies to disguise the taste, can we stop pretending that mince pies aren't terrible?
Oh, that would be wonderful. And so we could have that Christmas with no mince pies, no Brussels sprouts, and probably no Christmas pudding either.
I would go even further and say I would be all in favour of a Christmas without any actual Christmas, but I appreciate that I may be an outlier on that one. Still, it's only about another 6 months away. Anyway, that brings us to the end of today's show. Quentin Peel and Michael Goldfarb, thank you for joining us here at Midori House. The show was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Hunter Charlton. Our studio manager was George McDonough. There's more music next at 1900. It's The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. We'll have more in the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. It feels good saying bar humbug in the middle of July. I'm Andrew Miller. Thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.